noise. The lights flickered, and this time went out, along with all the monitors, plunging mission control, which had no windows, into darkness. A second later, the emergency lights came on, along with a series of alarms, including the fire alarm siren. A third thundering vibration struck the ship, weaker this time. Gideon rose to his feet, pulling himself up by a console. The monitors were still out, the dim emergency lighting barely adequate to illuminate the space. McFarland struggled up beside him, both of them bracing for the next attack. Nothing happened. Others were now getting up around them. Smoke was pouring out of a nearby console, and Gideon grabbed one of the ubiquitous fire extinguishers strapped to the walls and gave it a blast, extinguishing the embryonic fire. Leonard's voice came over the intercom system.
General quarters! All crew to general quarters! Seal all bulkheads! Security to bridge and engineering!
As the emergency announcement went on, McFarland said,
There's our reaction.
It felt like an explosion. Must have been some kind of sonic attack.
Yes, an ultra-low-frequency sonic attack with a remarkably high amplitude.
Gideon's radio buzzed and he pulled it out. It was Glynn.
I want you on the bridge, he said.
While Glynn was speaking, Gideon could feel the engines coming to life, along with the incipient movement of the ship. McFarlane overheard,
I'm coming too.
Gideon did not argue. Chapter 47. It was not a quick trip from the mission control room, deep inside the ship, to the bridge at the top of the superstructure. Gideon had only been on the bridge once before. It was a spacious area, far above the main deck, with floor-to-ceiling windows giving it sweeping views of the surrounding water and the ship itself, fore and aft. There was no internal illumination, save a dull red glow from the nighttime bridge lights, and from a few hooded chart plotters and monitors. A gibbous moon hung in the sky, casting a remarkably bright light over the scattered icebergs, which looked like ghosts on the dark water. Bright stars bristled in the overhead dome of night. As he stared at the moonlit view, Gideon saw something puzzling. The sea, as far as the eye could reach, was covered with shapes, big and small. It took him a moment to realize. They were thousands upon thousands of dead fish, along with much larger shapes of what looked like sharks and porpoises. And, about a quarter mile away, he made out a cluster of huge white corpses, some 50 feet or longer each, just beginning to drift to the surface. Dead whales. The ship was gaining speed. The scene on the bridge was one of tight efficiency, underlain with an intense urgency. First Officer Leonard was at the con, relaying the captain's orders regarding heading, engine, and rudder. Captain Tully stood next to her, a ramrod-straight fireplug of a man, murmuring his orders. Garza was nowhere in sight. He had gone off to oversee the security team searching the ship for the missing worms. Glynn was speaking to the officer of the watch, Warrant Officer Lund. Glynn turned and waved them over.
Why are we underway?
Asked McFarlane. Are we running? Glynn looked at McFarlane.
No. We've been attacked, and we're moving out of range in order to effect repairs.
The amplitude drops by the square of the distance, said Gideon, which means we probably don't have to go very far.
Correct. The calculation was 4 miles.
Mr. Lund, please brief them on the condition of the ship.
Yes, sir.
Lund, pale and blonde, turned his narrow face to them.
We're taking on water. The bulkheads were sealed and the bilge pumps can handle it. The electricity generators are offline. Fuel leaks, but should be fixed in an hour or so. The ship's navigational and engine equipment survived in pretty good shape. Ringo, which was at the depth of 1,000 meters at the time of the sonic attacks, is a complete loss. The other major damage was to mission control, which is full of delicate and sensitive electronics. The damage appears to be severe but not catastrophic. Monitors smashed, motherboards shaken loose, contacts broken. But the standalone computers, laptops, and desktops mostly survived intact. They were shaken up but seemed to be fine.
Thank you,
Mr. Lund, said Glynn. The warrant officer stepped back.
And the nuke? Asked McFarlane.
We haven't checked on it yet, said Glynn.
Don't worry about the nuke, said Gideon. Nuclear weapons are designed to be robust, built to be manhandled before being dropped.
Please make an examination, just to be sure, said Glynn.
Now we have a decision to make. Abort or proceed.
Gideon knew what he was going to say, but he waited. McFarlane looked at Glynn.
Let's hear your views first.
At this, a bitter smile gathered on Glynn's face.
Ah, Sam, for once you want to hear my views. My apologies, but I'm not giving you the opportunity to disagree with me just for the sake of it. You two make the decision. If it's a tie, I'll break it.
I say go ahead, said McFarlane after a moment.
Agreed, said Gideon.
In that case, we go ahead. We'll repair the ship and head back to the target area, with the goal of deploying the nuke as soon as possible.
Is there anything that can be done to protect the ship from a future attack like that?
Asked the captain, who had overheard the conversation.
I have an engineer working on it, Glynn told him. He thinks we can lower a set of metal sheets into the water to act as baffles. It won't block the sonic attack, but it may mitigate it. We have only a day, though.
The captain nodded.
The weather.
Exactly. A serious storm is approaching that will preclude any progress for at least a week. Whatever we do, it must be done in the next 24 hours. And in any case, he paused a moment. If we can't isolate and kill the missing worms, we're fighting a losing battle. Besides, the ship's complement can't go indefinitely without sleep.
He looked at Gideon and McFarlane. In other words, we can't afford to waste any more time with analysis. Let's go full speed ahead and take that thing out with the nuke. Chapter 48.
My drinking days are past, said McFarlane, in answer to Gideon's invitation.
It was 1 a.m., and McFarlane, in his usual brusque way, had invited himself into Gideon's cabin to discuss the seismic results, which Gideon had recently downloaded into his laptop. The results couldn't have been worse, and were a bad shock to Gideon. McFarlane, Cassandra that he was, had been correct in his pessimistic speculation. Like the icebergs that surrounded them, almost 90% of the creature was below the seabed. He heard a brief commotion in the hall, voices raised in argument. The entire ship was awake, and a few were already becoming strung out on amphetamines. Gideon felt the bulge in his own shirt pocket. A bottle of the pills sickbay had been liberally passing out. He hadn't taken any, and didn't intend to unless it became absolutely necessary. The truth was, he had no desire to sleep, and probably couldn't have even if he wanted to. The sweep of the ship, now being led personally by Garza, was still underway, although half the search parties had been pulled off to help with repairs. Not a single worm had been found, but in the interim, someone had sabotaged the CT scanner, destroyed it completely. The same had happened to the X-ray machine. Clearly, more people had been parasitized and were apparently doing the bidding of the mother creature. But how was the thing giving instructions? There was no way for it to communicate to the worms in the brains of the infected. Was there? The very low-frequency sound it emitted was fully damped down before reaching the ship. How did it even know what to do? Sabotaging the CT and X-ray machines required not only intelligence, but a sophisticated understanding of human technology. How was it possible? And this thought was what led to a sudden revelation. It was a crazy, perhaps even insane idea, but it was the only thing that fit all the facts and explained everything, even the mysterious "kill me" plea. Gideon would have to think hard about voicing his idea, because it seemed so outlandish. He glanced at the lean, weathered figure of McFarlane, bent over the laptop. He had rapidly come to respect, and in some ways depend on, the man's judgment, even if the way he expressed himself was frequently offensive.
he would test his idea on McFarlane first.
"Look at this," McFarlane said. "That cluster, there."
He turned the laptop screen toward Gideon, which displayed a picture of the area underground surrounding the creature.
"I've been using software to enhance it."
Gideon saw what looked like a grouping of ovoid objects, connected by thick cables.
"It's deep, over 1,000 feet below the seafloor. You know what I think? I think those are developing seeds. Or eggs."
Gideon stared.
"Look closely at the structure. There's a hard shell around them, forming a covering. And then a liquid medium surrounds a round nucleus, a sort of yolk-like suspension."
"How large are these? What's the scale?"
McFarlane did some typing, and a scale bar appeared. "Each one is about 3 feet in diameter along the long axis, 2 feet along the shorter axis. The nucleus inside is about 9 inches by 6.
The size and shape of a human brain." A long silence. He found McFarlane looking at him, curiously.
"Note," said Gideon, "that there appear to be 6 of them."
"Noted. What are you getting at?" McFarlane asked.
"We've lost 2 people to the creature, Lispinard and Frayne. We also found 3 headless corpses in and around the wreck of the Rolvag."
Gideon saw the light of dawning understanding in McFarlane's eyes.
"Go on," the meteorite hunter said quietly.
"Note also that Lispinard videoed what appeared to be a brain-like organ in the trunk of the creature. But that brain is much larger, about 15 inches in diameter."
A long silence.
"And?"
"I have a theory."
"Let's hear it."
"The baobab is a parasite, of course. But it's parasitism of a kind unknown on Earth. It takes the brains of other organisms. Why?"
2 reasons. First, because it has none of its own. So it parasitizes the brain of another organism, which provides it with the intelligence it requires."
McFarlane listened intently. "Now for the second reason. Dr. Bramble said Alex Lispinard's brain was missing when the thing voided the remains of her DSV. Not just missing, but carefully removed. The same thing may well have happened to Frayne before his DSV was excreted. And as I said, we found 3 corpses from the Rolvag that were all missing their heads. But the Rolvag is a damned huge wreck. Who's to say there wasn't a 4th headless body somewhere inside that we haven't seen?"
2 + 3 + 1,
said McFarlane.
"Precisely. That cluster of 6 objects, 1,000 feet below the seabed, are developing into seeds. But I think that, at their core, they contain human brains. 6 new creatures, each with its own intelligent brain. The 15-inch brain inside the trunk of the creature, on the other hand, is the one it brought with it, from outside the solar system."
"An alien brain."
"Exactly. Kill me, kill me. That was the alien brain speaking directly to us. That was not the baobab speaking. The alien brain wants to die, desperately. Can you imagine what it would be like to have your brain removed and incorporated into another life form, used as a slave processor or computer, and kept alive against its will for millions of years? Kept nourished, functioning, and sane? Think about the 4 things Prothero has so far translated from blue whale speech. Kill me. Long time. Far away. And perhaps, most telling of all, net. It explains the final words of both Alex and Frayne, words that suggest a sudden, surprising meeting of some kind. A meeting between the human brain and the alien brain. And it explains how the worms work. All they do is put a goal into their human's brain, a simple little goal. The parasitized human brain does all the complex thinking of how to achieve that goal, either to protect the mother plant or to steal a DSV and drive down to unite with it, to make another egg, just like the toxoinfection in a mouse brain Glenn described. Makes the mouse go to the cat, to be eaten. The parasite in the mouse isn't giving it detailed instructions. It just causes the mouse to lose its fear of cats. He paused,
realizing how ridiculous it all sounded. McFarlane didn't respond right away. He sat back in the chair, crossed his legs, and closed his eyes. For a long moment, he made no movement. And then he said, without opening his eyes, "Think of the existential horror of it. A brain with no body, no life, no interactions, no sensory input. Just endless existence. No wonder it wants to die. And no wonder, as Prothero reported, the communication ended so abruptly, both times. The baobab silenced the alien brain, kept it from continuing the conversation." Gideon let that thought sink in. If McFarlane was right, that meant Alex, effectively, was still alive. Her memories, her personality, everything she was, but trapped, disembodied in the creature, to be used as a vehicle for its procreation. The horror of it was almost beyond imagining. He opened his eyes. "Are you all right?" McFarlane asked. "No. Because you know the biggest irony of all? That thing had harvested 4 brains from the Rolvog, probably when it first sank, yet it remained quiescent. Now it has 2 more, and it's suddenly growing active. I think by coming down here, we provided it with just enough additional brains for it to move to the next stage of development. Instead of killing it, we've helped it to propagate." "Maybe so," McFarlane waved his hand. "But you know what? I think you've just figured out how to kill it. By destroying all 7 of those brains." Chapter 49. Patrick Bramble had done 6 months of a general surgery residency, which was how he discovered that he was not cut out to be a surgeon. He was not a team player, which had made for bad OR etiquette, and he did not enjoy working with his hands like a mechanic. And now here he was, performing emergency brain surgery. The patient, the exobiology lab assistant named Reese, lay anesthetized on the operating table, under bright lights. His head had been shaved, and the surgery area cleaned and scrubbed with betadine. Reese's cranium had been placed in a 3-pin Mayfield skull clamp, which held it rigidly in place, a testament to EES thoroughness that such a device happened to be in the surgical cabinets on board. He had already gone through a stressful procedure, guided in real time by a neurosurgeon in Australia via Skype, in which he had fixed a lumbar drain in the patient's lower back to remove some cerebrospinal fluid. This, the Australian neurosurgeon explained, was to loosen the brain and make it easier to operate on. Standing at his side and assisting was Dr. Sachs. This was little comfort. Sachs was, indeed, an MD, but she had gone on to get a PhD and had never practiced medicine, let alone surgery. She was, if anything, more nervous than he was. As for his own assistant, Rogelio, after Glynn's crew-wide announcement about the parasitic worms, the man had locked himself in his stateroom, refusing to come out under any circumstances. On a large monitor in front of him was Dr. Susanna Rios of Sydney, standing over a detailed plastic model of the head and shoulders of a human patient, lying face down. Next to it was a real human cranium. These were the props she was going to use to guide him through the surgery. This felt not unlike the nightmare that Bramble sometimes had, of finding himself in the cockpit of a plane, flying it after the pilot had suffered a heart attack, listening to the instructions of an air traffic controller on how to bring the plane in for a safe landing. The dream never ended well. "The craniotomy will proceed like this," Rios was saying. "We are going to remove most of the suboccipital bone in what we call a skull-based surgical procedure. We're taking out an unusually large bone flap because, while we know the parasite is in the vicinity, we don't know exactly where it is. You're sure it's in between the dura mater and the brain itself?"
"Yes."
"And the parasite itself is of a rare variety, about which little is known?"
"Quite rare."
"Very well. I'm going to draw a line on this model, where you'll make the initial incision." She drew a line with a magic marker, just behind the hairline. "Now you copy it on the patient."
"Yes, doctor."
He drew the same line on his patient with a sterile pen.
Dr. Bramble, your hand appears unsteady.
Bramble held it up.
It was indeed trembling.
Please close your eyes, take a deep breath, focus, and get that tremor under control.
Rio spoke sternly, yet calmly.
Bramble did as she instructed.
The trembling steadied.
Good. Make the incision like this.
She demonstrated with the scalpel on the plastic model.
He followed suit, the scalpel running lightly along the bone.
Guided by the Australian surgeon, Sachs followed the incision with electrical cauterizing tweezers, zapping any bleeders. In between, she used a sponge to keep the area wiped clear of blood.
Now the skin and muscles are to be lifted off the bone and folded back like this. Clip the edges of the incision with clamps and let the weight of the clamps hang down to keep the incision open.
She demonstrated with the plastic pieces of the model.
Bramble followed suit.
Very good.
Now, you're going to make 4 small burr holes in the skull with the perforator drill, like this.
She drew 4 black dots on the real skull model and demonstrated.
Bramble watched as, ever so gently and deftly, she cut a small hole in the cranium with the drill.
Go slow. The perforator must be held perpendicular to the bone. Do not stop or pull back until the drill stops itself, which it will automatically before it penetrates all the way through the bone.
Ready?
Bramble nodded. Sweat was running into his eyes, threatening to blind him.
Dr. Sachs, please mop my brow, he murmured.
He drew 4 black dots on the cranium, as indicated. He started the air-powered drill, which came up to speed with a soft whine. Then, taking another deep breath, he hovered over the bone with it.
Do not use downward pressure, Rio said.
He lowered the drill until it bit into the skull with a high-pitched rasp. He immediately smelled the bone and blood atomized by the device, even through his surgical mask.
Slow. Easy. That's it.
The drill stopped.
Pull out and do the next hole. Your assistant needs to be ready with a little bit of saline in there to cool it.
Bramble eased off and raised the drill, following her directions. In a few minutes he was done with the 4 holes.
The perforator, Rio said, leaves a very thin layer of bone at the bottom of each burr hole. It has to be taken out, like this.
She demonstrated with a funny-looking tool.
Bramble did not have the tool.
Use a small forceps instead, Rio said. He used the small forceps to remove the wafer-thin pieces of bone. He could now see the whitish, bluish-gray membrane, the dura, peeping through the holes.
Good. Now, you're going to cut from hole to hole using the craniotome. You will cut along the lines while your assistant uses the suction tube to draw up the saline solution, and also gently push down the dura, keeping it away from the saw tip. She should be dribbling the saline into the cutting edge to keep it lubricated and cool.
Once again, she demonstrated.
Ready, both of you?
Bramble nodded.
Turn on the craniotome. Go slow and steady. There's no hurrying anything in brain surgery.
He turned on the saw and it whispered up at a high pitch, like a mosquito. He began to cut along the line. Again, that smell came.
As he eased it along the line, Dr. Rios talked him through the procedure, gently correcting him as he went.
It took a long time, but was finally done.
He expelled air.
Sachs mopped his brow again.
Take a moment to rest.
Bramble closed his eyes, tried to think of something calming, and came up with Hamlet. He began quoting his favorite lines from Hamlet to himself. That worked well.
He opened his eyes.
Now you need to remove the bone piece with a pair of spirtles. Rios cleared her throat.
May I see your hands?
Bramble held up his hands. They were steady.
All right. Use the spirtles to remove the bone flap, but do it slowly and with the utmost care.
He took the spirtle set and, with infinite care, removed the oval piece of bone.
Put it aside in the prepared sterile container and...
Suddenly Rio stopped.
Oh my God!
Bramble could see, under the translucent dura membrane, a section of the worm. It was about a quarter inch thick and was coiled like a snake. It was moving slowly, with a continuous motion.
"What in the world is that?" Rios asked.
"It's the parasite."
"That's like no parasite I've ever seen, and I've been doing neurosurgery for 20 years.
"As I told you, it's rare."
"Right. Okay."
Now Rios was the one trying to collect herself. Bramble took a deep breath. He wanted to get this over with.
"Dr. Rios, shall we continue?"
"Yes, yes, of course. Let's see. Next, wash the dura gently with saline and remove any bone tips."
She demonstrated on her model with the suction tube and saline. Sax did it.
"Now we're going to put in 2 traction sutures with 4-0 silk."
"What's a traction suture?"
"It's a suture that forms an open loop of silk you can stick your finger through and use to lift something up. In this case, you will elevate the dura off the brain so you can cut it without nicking the organ itself, and raise the membrane off that parasite." Bramble nodded. As Sax gently washed down the dura and suctioned off bits of bone, the worm stopped its slow coiling, freezing in place. It seemed to have sensed something was going on. God, he hoped he hadn't disturbed the thing. If it slithered off into another part of the brain, they'd have to start all over again.
"This is new to me," said Rios.
"How do you propose to get that thing out?"
"I was thinking I could grab it with forceps through the dura, get a good grip before it escapes, then pull it out."
"The dura is a tough membrane. You can't pull it through. That would kill the patient. You've got to make an incision first."
"I understand, but I have to grab the thing by surprise." He paused. "I've got one shot at this."
"I'm beginning to see the problem.
Might I suggest injecting it with an anesthetic first?" "An anesthetic won't work."
Bramble didn't bother explaining the parasite came from beyond the solar system and had an alien biology. That, he knew, would not go down well with the good Dr. Rios. He cast his eye over the tray of tools, looking for one that would work. There were numerous sets of forceps, including several large ones with teeth.
"So tell me what you think I can do to get that thing out fast," he said.
"This is outside my area of competence," Rios said.
"Shouldn't you consult with someone who's got experience removing these types of parasites?" "There is no one. Just tell me how to do it, please."
"Well, the simplest way would be to start with those 2 traction sutures I mentioned, and use them to pull or lift the dura away from the parasite. Then you make an incision, grasp the parasite with forceps, and remove it."
Bramble looked at the worm. It had stopped moving, but it didn't seem alarmed. It looked almost as if it was waiting.
"All right, show me what to do on your model.
Keep in mind that any movement that impinges on the brain, even a tiny bit, can cause damage."
"Noted. Let's go."
"First the traction sutures," Rio said.
"These will be 2 loops of silk that your assistant can put her fingers through to lift or elevate the dura away from the, parasite."
She demonstrated on a second plastic model, using needles to form 2 loops of silk. She stuck her fingers through the loops and pulled upward, raising the membrane from the brain.
"Got it?"
"Got it." "The suturing needle should only go 2/3 of the way through the dura. Not all the way. Don't pierce it."
Bramble inserted the bent needle into the dura, worked it partway through, and then out. He was concerned about disturbing the worm. And in fact, as he worked the bent needle through the membrane, which was very tough, the worm did seem to grow disturbed, and at one point gave a jerk, coiling up tightly. But it stayed put. "Your assistant will now elevate the dura. Start the incision, and as she elevates it further, it will help you extend the incision to the desired opening. Keep in mind that working with forceps so close to the brain, even the smallest miscalculation—"
"I understand the risks," Bramble said, with ill-disguised impatience. "Dr. Sax, stick your fingers through those sutures and elevate the dura."
Bramble took up the large, toothed forceps with his left hand and the scalpel in his right, ready to go. Sax slipped her two forefingers through. The worm moved again, jerked a little, but it remained in place.
Lift a little more.
She pulled up ever so lightly. Again the worm jerked, then coiled up tightly, as if to protect itself as the membrane was lifted from it. Bramble poked the tip of the scalpel through the dura, and with a quick, smooth movement cut an opening an inch long, exposing the worm. It remained quiescent.
A little more.
The act of lifting helped him open the incision another inch. Now the worm finally seemed alarmed. It coiled itself still tighter. Then suddenly, its head appeared, raising just like a snake into striking position, pointing at Bramble's hovering forceps. Its black tooth suddenly unsheathed, like a viper's fang.
Good Lord, breathed Rios.
Bramble moved in with the forceps, slowly, like a cat. The thing seemed to be watching his hand approach, its head weaving slightly. Holding his breath, Bramble darted in and seized the creature across its body, the forceps hooks sinking in. It slashed about, striking at him like a snake as he pulled it out, at the same time whipping around with its tooth, stabbing its head into the patient's brain, wriggling around and then pulling its head out with a sucking sound. Blood gushed out.
Jesus!
Cried Rios. Now it went after Bramble, the head whipping back around again, the black tooth sinking into Bramble's hand. He gave a yell, but didn't let go, the thing thrashing and stabbing, striking him again and again.
Son of a bitch!
He cried, throwing it into a container previously prepared for it. Sax slammed the lid. A frantic skittering and high-pitched squealing filled the room. Ignoring his own slashed hand, Bramble turned back to the patient. Blood was welling out of the hole the worm had made, flowing down the sides of the head. The life support alarms began to beep on the monitoring equipment. The EKG was going crazy. And then, even as he stared, it flatlined, and the respiration fell to zero. Rhys died before his eyes, his blood running over the operating table and streaming to the floor.
Doctor, you're bleeding, said Sax, grasping his forearm and pressing sterile pads on the cuts.
He turned on her.
Throw that devil in the blender!
She obeyed. Bramble pressed the pads against his cut hand, hoping to the living God that the thing wasn't poisonous. He turned back to the monitor. Dr. Susanna Rios was still there, staring at the scene with an expression of pure, speechless horror on her face. Her mouth was moving, but no sound came.
So sorry, doctor, Bramble said. Please stand by. We have another patient.
He heard the blender go on, the squealing of the worm cut short as it was reduced to a gray paste. He experienced a wave of dizziness, felt Sax gripping his arm, and leading him to a chair, sitting him down, giving him a glass of water, and then unwrapping his wounded hand.
Let's take a look at your injuries, she said. Just sit back.
We don't have time, said Bramble, rising. We need to bring in Stallweather.
Chapter 50 At 4 in the morning, Gideon was in his quarters, alone, working at his small desk. The simulation was almost finished. It was finally coming through, after almost 40 hours of CPU time on the ship's IBM Vulcan Q supercomputer. He had a bad feeling. The fundamental question was how deep and wide the nuke's shock wave would penetrate into the sea floor. But the sea floor was composed of pelagic sediments, essentially loose, wet clay. It was like a soft blanket, the worst material imaginable for propagating a powerful shockwave. The six brains, which looked like they were being encapsulated into new seeds, were 1,000 feet deep and off to one side of the creature. McFarlane was surely right. If they could kill all the brains the creature had collected, they would certainly kill the creature itself as well. The thing was a parasite that needed a brain in order to survive, and additional brains to reproduce. Kill all of them, and it would soon die, if it couldn't get any more. He watched the window on his computer screen, meaningless numbers scrolling by. The Q machine was still thinking. Simulating a nuclear explosion 2 miles below the surface of the ocean was a massive computing job, but all indications were that it was almost done. A soft knock came at the door. Gideon didn't answer. The door opened anyway, and Glynn entered. "May I?"
"You're already in."
Glynn came in and eased himself onto the bed, iPad in hand. His face looked drawn, but otherwise he appeared fine, not tired and certainly not half-crazed, like so many others on board. But if you looked closely, there was a gleam in his eye that had not gone away, a gleam of deep and abiding obsession. Gideon knew that gleam, because he felt the obsession as well. It was a need, an overwhelming need, to destroy the thing, no matter what the cost.
"Where's Sam?" Glynn asked.
"He disappeared. Said he had some thinking to do." Glynn nodded. "We now have a more complete report on the biology of the creature, which I want to share with you because it may have a bearing on how readily it can be killed."
"Shoot."
"It's a carbon, hydrogen, silicon, oxygen form of life. Essentially, it's built of organic chemistry like us, but with the addition of silicon. Mostly in the form of silicates and silicon dioxide. On our planet, marine diatoms seem the closest biochemical analogy. They extract silicon from water and build their bodies out of silicates. Some plant species also incorporate silicates."
"I don't really give a shit. I just want it dead."
Glynn went on, as if he hadn't heard. "And much of the carbon appears to be in pure form, in exotic allotropes, nanofibers, nanotubes, nanobuds, nanofoam, fullerenes, graphite, and diamond. It has silicon dioxide fiber optic wires that transmit digital signals using light. The various exotic carbon fibers transmit electricity, some apparently with superconductance. Instead of muscle fibers, the entity has bundles of carbon fibers that can be contracted or relaxed. Many hundreds of times more powerful than any muscle fiber. That's how it could crush a titanium sphere."
"Where is all this going?"
"Patience, Gideon. The question is, did this thing evolve, or was it built? Is it a machine or a biological entity, or some kind of hybrid? We don't know. But here's what we do know." He laid his iPad on the bed. "The tremblors in the seafloor around it are almost constant. We've been analyzing them. The thing appears to be extending its roots or tentacles at an incredible rate, hundreds of feet an hour. The main body of those roots are heading for the South American continent."
"Good God."
Glynn paused, shifting on the bed.
"We are out of time.
The creature is growing too rapidly, the roots growing outward at a geometric pace, and now it looks like nodes are beginning to develop on those roots. In other words, it's getting ready to push up new baobabs, like mushrooms after a rain, to collect more brains, more seeds, which gives us an idea, an educated guess, about the creature's endgame."
"Tell me about it."
"In short order, a network of baobabs will circle the globe, forming, in effect, a giant fist around it. Once that happens, the fist will flex, popping the surface off the Earth like a giant tomato, and breaking up the planet in the process, thus ejecting the seeds into space to find other worlds to parasitize. Each seed will contain its own parasitized brain."
"How did you figure this out?"
"Think about it. I've hinted at this before. Breaking up the planet is the only way for it to liberate those gigantic seeds." Gideon glanced at the window on his monitor. The numbers were still flashing by.
"The situation on board this ship is becoming untenable," Glynn said. "We're losing control.
The Q machine's quantitative behavioral analysis indicates we have only about 12 hours left before discipline breaks down entirely, and we have either a mutiny or chaos on board ship."
"So your QBA is what's been slowing down my simulation."
"My apologies, but understanding the human factor is crucial." Gideon nodded. Despite all our precautions, other personnel have been parasitized by the worms. We know this because of the widespread sabotage. Not just the CT scanner and the X-ray machine, but the ship's surveillance cams as well. The whole system is down, and the vessel's intercom isn't working everywhere. All this is slowing down our efforts to find the worms and identify the saboteurs.
Again, I'm wondering where this is going.
We must deploy the nuke now. And I mean now, within 12 hours.
Gideon glanced over at his workstation. I need the numbers first. If the nuke won't kill those underground eggs, there's no point in setting it off.
And when do you expect the numbers?
Any moment.
Doesn't the computer tell you how long the calculation will take?
It's not a calculation. It's a simulation. A much vaster scale of complexity.
Glynn rose. Forget the simulation. We've got the weapon. Let's use it.
He looked at his watch.
I want the nuke armed and loaded in the ROV in a matter of hours.
He turned.
Can you do it?
As Glynn stared at him, Gideon became aware, once again, of the obsession they both shared.
Fuck yes, he said, almost surprising himself.
Glynn nodded.
Good.
And then he left. Just as the door shut, as if on cue, Gideon's monitor chimed. The window was blinking red. The simulation was complete. Gideon rushed to the computer and, not even bothering to sit, began furiously calling up the numbers from the queue. The file came in slowly. It was fat, but in a minute it had loaded, numerical simulations made visual. A schematic picture appeared, and a slow-motion video began playing, simulating the detonation of the nuke, the expanding shockwave, the massive cavitation caused by the blast, the transitioning of seawater into steam, the effect of it on the baobab, and the impact of the leading edge of the shockwave with the seafloor and its propagation beneath. In a minute, it was over. Still standing, Gideon now sought to sit down, placing an arm on the swivel desk chair. But something went awry. His legs were like jelly, and the chair slipped on its wheel sideways, and he collapsed on the floor. Chapter 51. Bramble had never felt so shattered in his life. He was weary to the marrow. He sank into the chair in his clinic, eased his legs out one after the other, and leaned back. His limbs felt like lead. He and Sachs had lost both patients, one after the other. In the first case, the parasite had killed Reese while it was being extracted. In the second, Bramble had followed Rios's recommendation and injected the parasite with hydrochloric acid, which did in fact kill it, but not quickly enough. As soon as he stuck the needle in the worm, it lashed out and killed the patient. After Stallweather had died on the operating table, he'd been forced to give the near-hysterical Dr. Sachs a sedative, but to prevent her from sleeping, he added to it a cocktail of mild stimulants, caffeine and methylphenidate HCL, that had put her into a wakeful but dissociated state. He had installed her in a chair in the back room of the clinic, where she was resting but not sleeping. He had checked on her several times and found she was alert enough. Not that he really believed there were worms hiding in the clinic. They had killed both worms recovered from the patients, blending them into paste and incinerating them. The cuts on his arm were sore, but they were just cuts. So far there was no sign of any exposure to toxins. Which made sense. The worm's tooth did not have a channel to inject venom, as a viper's fang did. Nor did there appear to be any venom-containing organs inside the creature. His dispensary, down the hall and currently in the pharmacist's care, had been dispensing pills all night long. The steady stream of patients had ended, and it was close to dawn. He himself had not taken the speed. He had been a doctor too long to think it was a good idea, and he was surprised and even dismayed that Glynn had ordered it. But there it was. Glynn was not someone who consulted him on decisions like this. Bramble feared the wakeful atmosphere on board the ship more than he feared the unlikely possibility of being parasitized. The stress and fear, he believed, could easily deteriorate into stimulant-induced psychosis in many crew members. In this ruminative state, he found his eyes closing,
and he jerked himself awake. Just 2 more hours to sunrise. What he should be doing was keeping busy, and the best way to do that was to start working on a blood test that would show if someone had been parasitized. Bramble had drawn vials of blood from the 2 patients, and if he could find something unusual in that blood, something anomalous, something not present in the blood of an uninfected person, that could be used as a blood test. He roused himself and shuffled over to the equipment cabinets. He would start with a standard CBC on the blood, measuring hemoglobin and red and white blood cell numbers. From there, he would go on to a basic metabolic panel testing heart, liver, and kidney function, blood glucose, calcium, potassium, and other electrolyte levels. Maybe a lipoprotein panel next, if nothing anomalous showed up. He hoped to God something would show up, and it very well might. Surely the body would react in some way to having a 6-inch parasite moving around in the brain. God, he was tired. Stay on your feet. You couldn't accidentally fall asleep on your feet, he knew. Maybe he should just take 1/2 a pill. Once again, he put this thought out of his head. No amphetamines. He needed to keep his head as clear as possible. Removing the rack of vials from the refrigerator, he had taken 13 vials of blood from each patient, he began sorting and labeling them for the various tests. Then he went through the equipment lockers, taking out the necessary equipment and setting it up while going through the steps in his mind. As a doctor, he normally sent tests like this off to a lab, but back in medical school at RCSI, he had learned how to do them himself. On top of that, he had the internet, and surely somewhere there he would find the lab protocols. He jacked his laptop into the ship's network and went online. Yes, there it all was, in exacting detail. He would start with a simple blood smear test. He took a drop of blood from one of the vials and spread it on a gridded slide, stained it, and covered it. He put the slide under the microscope and, pencil in hand, began counting the number, size, and shape of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets per grid, jotting down the figures. But he was so tired, he was having trouble focusing. He blinked, blinked again, and adjusted the focus on the stage. God, his eyes were so shot from the failed operations, he couldn't see through the eyepieces. And it had to be admitted, he wasn't as young as he once was, less able to stand up to the grueling hours he had once endured as a resident. He blinked again, then took some eye drops out of the medicine cabinet and applied them to his eyes. Once again, he gazed through the eyepieces, but it was like trying to see underwater. Bloody hell. What he needed was a 10-minute break with his eyes shut. His judgment was growing affected. He needed to be sharp in order to continue the tests. He glanced at the chair. Could he close his eyes without dropping off to sleep? But a quick 10-minute nap hardly seemed dangerous and, in fact, might work wonders. The idea that there were worms lurking somewhere in the room, waiting for him to go to sleep, was absurd. There would be no danger in just a 10-minute nap, and it would do him and the work he had to do a world of good. The ship was huge, and the clinic was small, and had watertight bulkhead doors all around, which could be dogged shut. He went to the main door into the clinic, eased it shut, and dogged it. He shut the door to the inner lab as well. Then he took his cell phone out of his pocket, set the alarm to ring in 10 minutes, and placed it on the counter, starting the timer as he did so. God, he could hardly wait. He eased himself into the chair, leaned back, and closed his eyes. What a glorious feeling it was. A dream woke him. A nightmare. With a muffled cry, he jerked awake, feeling a sudden stinging pain, a horrible rasping vibration inside his head. His mind, confused and frightened, took a moment to clamber up out of darkness into the real world. His hands flew to his face, and he felt something, and he fell out of the chair to the ground. Good God in heaven, there was something on him. It was like a wriggling cable, hard and cold as steel. It was on his face, and inside his nose, digging into his nose. With a second muffled cry, he managed to grasp the tail end of it and tried to pull it out. He could feel the thing's incredibly strong muscles rippling in his frantic grasp as he tugged, but it wouldn't come free. It had fixed itself inside and was working its way deeper, rasping and digging into his nasal cavity. He rolled about on the floor, hanging on to the thing's tail with maniacal intensity, trying to keep it from going deeper, but it was too well anchored, working its way in despite his every painful effort to pull it out. Suddenly he felt, deep inside his head, a snapping of bone, like a finger poked through an eggshell. And then, everything changed. The terror vanished, and he felt a wonderful, spreading sensation of peace and contentment. And a blessed feeling of sleep stole over him. Beautiful, serene sleep. Dr. Antonella Sachs stood in the doorway of the inner lab, rubbing her eyes and trying to focus. She had heard something. A cry, perhaps, although she wasn't sure. But nothing was awry. Dr. Bramble lay on the floor, sleeping. His hands were folded on his chest, and an expression of contentment lay across his face. She leaned over to wake him up, gave him a little shake. Dr. Bramble? No response. The poor man had been going 36 hours straight and was out like a light. He had locked the door, and she noticed his cell phone on the lab table counting down the seconds. She picked it up. He had set it for a 10-minute nap and had 2 more minutes to go. The poor, tired man. 10 minutes seemed like nothing. Seeing him asleep so peacefully made her feel the lure of sleep herself. The shot Bramble had given her seemed to be wearing off, or at least it was no longer able to counteract the tidal wave of fatigue that pressed at her mind. She was aware that her rationality was still somewhat affected by the shot, that she wasn't thinking as clearly as she normally did. But who could be expected to after the ordeal they had just gone through? God knew the doctor needed a longer rest, and so did she. What risk would there be in a half-hour nap? That would be a lot more effective than 10 minutes. The door to the clinic was securely dogged, and surely Glynn's no-sleep edict did not apply to herself and Bramble, who needed to be as sharp as possible if they were going to be effective. She reset the phone alarm to go off in 30 minutes, and then eased herself into a lab chair and sat back, placing her feet up on the table, closing her eyes, and falling almost immediately into a delicious sleep. Chapter 52. Gideon left his cabin and headed for Mission Control, where he knew he would find Glynn. As he walked down the corridor, he heard, as he passed through crew quarters, voices raised in querulous complaint. A man came careening down the hall, smelling of alcohol, bumped into him, gave him an elaborate bow, and staggered on. As he passed the open door to the crew's mess, he saw that a crowd had gathered, talking urgently among themselves. He hurried on. Glynn was right. They had very little time before things fell apart on the ship, if they weren't beginning to already. He wondered how the man would react to the news he was carrying. The door to Mission Control was locked, but after identifying himself on the intercom, he entered. Glynn was there, along with McFarlane. Both were hunched over a monitor. It was a view of the baobab from the stationary camera. It was horribly active, the mouth extruding and swelling, then retracting, as if it were exercising some grotesque sex organ. "The simulation is finished," said Gideon. They both looked up. Gideon had been debating in his mind the best way to say it, but when actually faced with the task, his carefully crafted explanation vanished. "It won't work," he said simply. "Won't work?" McFarlane repeated sharply. "Not even close. The sediments act like a blanket. The shockwave won't reach that cluster of brains." "I don't believe it," McFarlane said harshly. "Bury the nuke in the mud and set it off there. That'll excavate a crater down to them." Gideon shook his head. "I already considered that. The simulation looked at various detonation altitudes above and within the seafloor. The best location is about 200 meters above the bottom. the water pressure would propagate the shockwave to a larger area of seafloor where it would penetrate the farthest, but not far enough.
Let's see those simulations, said Glynn.
They're on the ship's network. Gideon turned to the monitor, pulled up a keyboard, logged on, and ran the video simulation with all its various permutations, starting with the nuke exploding at the level of the seafloor, and then working up to a detonation half a mile above the baobab. Each simulation showed the shockwave moving in slow motion through the water, hitting the ground, and continuing on, damping down and petering out in 500 to 600 feet of depth. None of them reached the cluster of eggs at 1,000 feet deep.
I can't believe it, McFarlane exploded. This is a fucking nuclear weapon! You've set the parameters wrong.
No, Gideon said. The problem is, these deep-sea pelagic sediments are like a wet blanket. If it were solid rock, it would be totally different, but it's not. It's like jello.
So what's the answer? McFarlane asked furiously.
What have we got more powerful than a nuke?
Can we go get an H-bomb? What else can we do? This is fucked up. Why wasn't this simulation done 6 months ago?
He halted his tirade, breathing heavily. Gideon looked at him. He felt utterly defeated. And to think he'd seriously considered reprogramming the nuke's onboard computer so he could override an abort code, just in case the others got cold feet. What a joke. Now there was no question. Everyone wanted to use the nuke, and every hour counted. But the damned thing wouldn't be enough to kill the entity. Glynn spoke quietly.
Are there any options, Gideon?
Gideon shook his head.
One nuke, one shot.
Chapter 53. Rose Marie Wong had locked the door to the marine acoustics lab and was straightening up, trying to put the lab back into a semblance of order after Garza and his team had swept the place for worms. Prothero would have a fit if he came in and found it like this. Although it was just as messy when Prothero was there, he always claimed to know where every little thing was. And it was true. If she moved so much as a pencil in one of his staggering piles of crap, he would notice and berate her. She was deeply concerned about what was happening on board the ship. Several times in the past hour, she had heard groups of people passing by in the narrow corridor outside the lab, talking in loud, angry voices, their boots ringing on the metal floor. Some of them sounded like they had been drinking, while others appeared wired from the amphetamines that were being passed out like candy. Where was Prothero? He had been working on his whale lexicon for much of the night, but then had excused himself and left, saying he'd be back in 15. But it had been almost an hour, and he still wasn't back. Had he gone to sleep, defying regulations? That would be just like him. The way to get Prothero to do something was to ask him to do its opposite. Wong told herself she shouldn't be worried. Prothero maintained a completely unpredictable schedule, coming and going at all hours of the day and night, never eating in the mess, but instead chowing down in the lab itself, at random times, on pizzas and sodas brought in from the canteen. He would typically kick the trash into a corner, and it would then be up to her to retrieve it, put it in the garbage, and then empty the garbage at regular intervals to get rid of the oniony smell of pizza, which she loathed. Once again, through the door, she heard a group pass by. Once again, she heard the muffled, angry voices. This was truly disturbing. Where was security? But she knew the answer to that. Garza had commandeered them all in the search for the worms. In the meantime, the ship's discipline was rapidly heading for a complete breakdown. She heard the door rattle. A gasp.
Hey, Wong! Open up!
Prothero. She got up, unlocked the door, opened it. He rushed in, slamming the door and locking it. He was gasping for breath, sweaty, his hair askew, sucking in air.
What is it? She asked. What's happened?
Son of a bitch, he said. The motherfuckers have gone crazy. It was only 5 minutes, maybe 10 at most, I swear. There was a sudden thundering of footsteps outside the door, a rattling of the doorknob.
Prothero? Prothero!
a voice called, with an eruption of other voices behind.
Prothero backed away from the door.
Tell them I'm not here,
he whispered to Wong.
Wong swallowed.
He's not here, she said through the door.
Bullshit, came the reply. We know he's in there. Open up.
A number of angry voices were raised on the other side of the door, and someone began pounding.
Who is that? Wong? Open the fucking door, Wong!
Prothero, terror in his eyes, shook his head at her. He backed up, casting around the lab as if for a place to hide. There was none, of course.
He's not here, she said again.
Listen up, Wong. He's infected. We caught the son of a bitch sleeping. Couldn't wake him up. He's got a worm.
Wong felt paralyzed. She glanced at Prothero. He didn't look right, but then he rarely looked normal.
Are you listening? He's infected. Get your ass out of there and let us take care of it.
Prothero shook his head, mouthing, no, no, no. Wong couldn't decide how to reply. She felt paralyzed. Boom. Someone slammed into the door. Boom. The door was not a bulkhead, and she could see it bow inward with each body blow.
Open up, Wong. If you won't save yourself, we will.
I don't have a worm,
Prothero screamed.
I swear, I just took a short nap, that's all.
He's in there.
There was a tumult of shouting and expostulation beyond the door.
Wong, for God's sake, he's dangerous. Let us in now.
I'm not dangerous, I swear.
Wong looked once again at Prothero. His eyes were bloodshot, he was soaked in sweat, and his body was twitching and jumping with panic and fear. He did look infected. He read the meaning in her eyes.
No, no,
he said, swallowing and trying to speak without screaming.
I'm not, Rosemary, I swear it. They're crazy. I took a nap, 5 minutes. I was out like a light, but I'm not infected. Remember, if you're infected, they can't wake you for 2 hours, and
boom. And now the metal door handle rattled and came loose.
Boom.
Wong made a decision.
No, she yelled at the men trying to break down the door. You can't do this without evidence.
Boom. The handle sprang off the door.
You need proof, she yelled.
Boom. The door flew open and a huge man forced his way through. She was shocked. It was Vince Brancacci, the ship's jovial chef. He did not look jovial now, with a meat cleaver in his hammy, hairy fist. A crowd surged in behind him, half a dozen men armed with tools, crowbars, wrenches, hammers.
There he is! No, Prothero said. Please, God, no!
The crowd, realizing they had Prothero trapped, suddenly seemed to hesitate.
He's infected, Brancacci said, advancing with the cleaver. He's finished. We need to get rid of the worm inside him.
No, no, please,
Prothero whispered, shrinking back against a rack of computer equipment. Wong stepped in between Brancacci and Prothero and drew herself up to her full height, towering above Brancacci.
You can't kill a man without evidence. You can't do it!
We have evidence, said the chef.
Which is? Wong asked.
He was sleeping. He couldn't be woken up. And look at him! Just look at him! He's not acting normally!
You wouldn't be acting normally if you were being chased by a mob.
Get out of my way, said Brancacci, threateningly.
She could smell the sour odor of Brancacci's sweat.
Don't do this, she said quietly. Just turn around and go. You can't execute a man based on such weak evidence.
He reached out, grasped her shoulder with one powerful hand.
Please step aside.
No.
With a wrenching motion, he threw her aside. He was strong, and the action sent her tumbling into a rack of equipment, which fell with her to the floor with a crash. Momentarily stunned, Wong sat there as the mob moved in, stepping over and around her.
God, 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 please, no, no, no!
She heard Prothero sobbing and pleading. Brancacci swung the cleaver at his head, striking him above the eye with a sickening, hollow sound. Prothero screamed, going down, blood splattering, his head already coming apart. Brancacci drew back and, taking careful aim, swung the cleaver again. The scream was cut short. Prothero lay on the floor, unmoving. The chef now stepped over Prothero, straddling him, and brought the blade of the cleaver down once again, driving it into his skull and opening it up like a melon. Wong turned her head and closed her eyes. She heard a frantic struggle, shouts of, "Find it, get the worm!" But then the tumult rapidly fell into silence. She opened her eyes. Brancacci was still standing, spraddle-legged over Prothero's body, cleaver in hand. The rest had formed a silent circle around the fallen scientist, staring down at his remains, his skull and brains strewn across the floor in a pool of spreading blood.
"Stupid bastards!" Wong cried. "Are you satisfied now? Do you see? There is no worm!"
Chapter 54. Manuel Garza paused at the bottom of the engine room stairs and wiped his face with a cloth. He was exhausted from the tedium of searching the ship and finding nothing. It was maddening. They knew the worms were on board. They had attacked several crew members, coming out of nowhere and then disappearing. But how do you find a 6-inch, pencil-thin, gray worm on a research vessel packed with a million miles of wires and cables? And the engine room promised to be one of the worst places of all. Frederick Monckton, the ship's chief engineer, a dapper French-Canadian with a pencil mustache, was waiting for them, along with the first assistant engineer, two junior engineers, and a fireman. Garza had four guys in his immediate crew: Deputy Security Chief Ivan Vinter, and three other security personnel. He had disarmed them. He didn't want pistols being fired in the confined spaces below decks, where rounds could ricochet all over, and vulnerable equipment abounded. Instead, they carried heavy tools, hatchets and crowbars, as weapons. Garza had not had occasion to visit the engine room before. It was a large, hot, stuffy room, smelling of diesel fuel and oil lubricants. But on the plus side, it was at least a walk-around space, with steel floors kept spotlessly clean. The main diesel engine ran half the length of the room, and was painted light gray, and it stood alongside three synchronized diesel generators, painted blue and yellow, that provided the ship with electric power, primary, and backup. The rest of the room was a forest of pipes carrying fuel, seawater coolant, oil, and internal engine coolant. Running along the ceiling was a massive amount of ductwork. It looked well maintained and organized. The personnel who had gathered, in uniform, to help his team go through the engine room appeared steady and professional. They had not succumbed to the hysteria that had been spreading topside. For this, Garza was truly grateful. He plucked the radio from his belt.
"Eduardo, do you read?"
A moment later, the clipped voice of Betances, the chief of security, replied.
"Roger. Your teams find anything?"
"Not a thing."
"Very well. Keep me informed. Garza out."